For NPR Music, this is Alt Latino. I'm Jasmine Garst. Felix Contreras is away. Often on Alt Latino, we like to invite authors to talk about their work. And this week, we've got a real literary treat for your ears. So a few months ago, I got a copy of a book called Immigrant Voices. And I was really excited about the fact that it had stories about the immigrant experience by some of my favorite authors, like Juno Diaz and Eduardo Alfon. And it also had a lot of stories from authors I've never heard about, but I was thrilled to discover. We've invited a handful of the writers featured in this book to read parts of their stories. And these are just excerpts of longer stories. So consider this week's show kind of like a literary appetizer. We're not going to be playing a lot of music on this week's show. It's going to be word heavy, but we are going to be featuring bits and pieces of the music of Cuban pianist Omar Sosa. The book is edited by Megan Bales and Achi Abejas, and today we're joined by Achi Abejas. She's going to be our guide through the readings. Achi, for those of you who don't know, is a Cuban-American journalist based in Chicago. She herself is an immigrant. She immigrated to the U.S. at age 6. Hi, Achi. How are you? Thank you so much for joining the show today.
Hi, how are you? I'm very glad to be here and very happy that we're talking about this book.
Me too. It's just a wonderful book, and I'm so excited that we get to navigate it with you and talk about some of the thinking that went behind. It's so complex, and there's so many awesome authors. And so much of the immigrant narrative, as we hear it in the U.S., kind of starts in the U.S., right? You don't often hear about what brings people over.
Right. We really think that the story doesn't start here. We think that being here is sort of, frankly, the middle part of that narrative. The story really starts in the home countries when people make a decision or have a decision made for them that forces them out of the place that they're from, their home country, their patria, if you want to say it in Spanish. And we think that there are many reasons why people come here. I think the dominant narrative is that people come here looking for a better life, which is a really, to me, a fascinating phrase, this idea of a better life. And I think that what gets left out of that phrase is for whom that better life is, because frequently people come here looking for a way to make a better life for their children and not so much for themselves. And I also think people come here looking for a better life, not because it is significantly or materially better, but because conditions in their home country may be, in fact, even only temporarily bad, specifically for them. And this notion of the better life that has sort of dominated the idea of immigrant fiction in the U.S., especially in the 20th century, also comes with this other veneer of assimilation and wanting to be American.
Right.
And one of the things that Megan Bales, my co-editor, and I talked about when we were putting together this book is that, in fact, that is not really the way it's working in the 21st century. The way immigration works in the 21st century is actually much more fluid. People come here for many, many, many reasons. And it's important to acknowledge that people come here for economic reasons, people come here for political reasons, that people come here thinking this is a very temporary event, which is a radical departure of immigrant thinking before, because the journeys were so long in terms of the experience of actually traversing them. People frequently thought coming to the New World was a pretty permanent condition. But in the 21st century, people don't think being here is necessarily a permanent condition. And so it's a much more fluid sort of impetus that brings people here. And even the political sort of stuff is very complicated, because there's the formal asylum seekers, and then there are the people who are here in a very, you know, very much as refugees, but for whom the formalities of asylum don't apply. And so it's a very complicated, very nuanced sort of universe of reasons that people come here. And it affects how people function once they're here.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the book does a really good job at kind of capturing that complexity. And one of the things that struck me right off the bat, the book starts off with a story by Evelina Galang from the Philippines, which we're going to hear her reading shortly. And one of the things that struck me about that story is that it does a really good job at capturing kind of this reluctance to leave. Like, I mean, it's, you know, I can say in my own experience of really feeling like things are really bad back home and things are falling apart and I should go and maybe things will be better. But there's always some reluctance, you know, to get out, right?
Absolutely. I mean, this is your home. This is the place where you grew up. This is where, you know, you have your touchstones, your family, your the things that make you you are in this place, and you are literally leaping into the unknown. I mean, you may think you know America from pop culture, from TV, whatever, but the truth of the matter is that you have no idea what that's going to mean to you. You have no idea how, you know, you're going to be able to function in this new world that you are leaping into. So it's a very scary place for a lot of people, and I think that the other component of the reluctance, which I think was not very present in 20th century immigration, but I think is very present in 21st century immigration to the U.S., is this idea that you know people now who have not done well.
Yes.
The myth in the 20th century was that you went to America and you absolutely did better. You know, it was by definition a success story. And if it wasn't a success story, you were ashamed and you didn't talk about it. But in the 21st century, it's impossible to hide those failures. And, you know, there's much greater media coverage. Information just has a much more, a quicker and faster and longer life. And also the products of those failures frequently report back in a kind of an eyewitness way. So now leaping into that great unknown is no longer any kind of even symbolically hopeful guarantee.
It's so interesting that you're saying that. You know, I've been doing a lot of work reporting on Central American immigrants who come up on this freight train known as the Beast. And it's almost like a revolving door. You know, so many of them get deported, just bounce back,
right,
come back, because, I mean, the situation in Central America is so horrific with the violence. And one of the things you definitely off the bat notice when you're talking to people is this idea that there is no this fantasy that, you know, when you get to the U.S., it's going to be streets paved in gold. I mean, there's no delusion about that. It's understood that the life of an immigrant, especially if you're undocumented, is incredibly hard. The hours are incredibly long. The pay, I mean, it's certainly better than in your home country, but it's a very, very difficult life, which goes back to this idea of it's really not going to be that great for me personally, but it'll be good for my children.
Right. And I think that for asylum seekers or for people who come here for political reasons, that who aren't looking for streets paved with gold, but are looking for some sort of, again, mythical freedom, that dream is also tarnished. Because now, unlike in the 50s and 60s, you know, we know that if you're dark-skinned in the U.S., you're going to suffer. I'm not saying that that didn't happen in the 50s and 60s. It absolutely did happen. But there was no sense of it being as pervasive in the media in our home countries as it is now. You know, prior to the civil rights movement, most people didn't quite grasp just how very racist a situation it could be in the U.S., especially in the South. I mean, my parents, when they came here from Cuba, we came in 1963, and one of their great shocks, and my parents are educated people. You know, my mom was a social worker in Cuba. My dad was a lawyer in Cuba. So these are not people who didn't have access to information. They actually had quite a bit of access to information at the time, right? But when they came to the U.S. and they were in Florida, they were absolutely shocked out of their gourds to see, you know, separate drinking fountains. My parents worked as agricultural workers and picking tomatoes for quite a while in Florida, and they were stunned that there were two different food trucks, one for the white workers and one for the black workers. And of course, the Cubans were all kinds of colors, so there was tremendous confusion. They actually ended up, by choice, they didn't challenge the white truck. They ended up eating over at the so-called, you know, color truck. But it was an education for them to discover that they were, A, so-called colored, and B, that this system of segregation was so deeply embedded. I mean, Cuba is a multiracial society, has always been a multiracial society, and even at its worst points, it never had such an institutionalized racist structure. So the idea of freedom that my parents had was very compromised once they actually confronted the reality of American life.
This is a really good time to jump into the first reading.
My name is Evelina Galang, and here's an excerpt from Letting Go to America. It is the story of my character who has lost her husband and is speaking with him in dreams about their plans of a better life for their family. At night, she cannot sleep without him in her bed. She calls him. She finds him in half dreams. She sees them as teenagers in the province, walking down dirt paths on the way to the dagat, pulling off their clothes and slipping into the cool water. The dreams always begin this way, when they are children getting to know each other, learning how to touch each other, how to read one another. Beautiful dreams under wide banyan trees or huddled together, riding a motorcycle to the market in the height of rainy season. And as the night wears on, they grow older. They move to the city. They have the girls. First Angel, then Leela. Some years, there's not enough money for new shoes. One year, the van breaks down, and they eat rice and fish sauce every night for almost 6 months. They grow middle-aged. They sit in the dark after 2 weeks of off and on brownouts. No fans, no aircon, just heat. Just hot air not moving. They bathe in buckets of cold water to stay cool. They fill the house with used appliances, thinking it will save them money, only to watch them surge, spark, and blow out. By 2 in the morning, when she should be in her deepest sleep, they have outgrown their house, their barangay, the city of Manila. "What kind of life is this?" he asks her. "Our life. We barely get by. And what about my mother, Lola Ani? Matanda na, getting weaker each year. She is stronger than any of us." He wants to save money to buy them plane tickets to get them to America. That's the life for our girls, Mahal, different than our life. And when she doesn't buy that, he reminds her that just to make ends meet, they work 2 jobs. Driving foreigners around the islands is lucrative, but he has to work long, hard days, has to travel out of the city to other provinces. "Do you like when I'm gone for weeks?" he asks her. "Do you think I like that?" The dream he spins moves their whole family bit by bit to Chicago. "First you," he says, "and you establish our life, Nurse Mahal. Then we save money and send Angel, tapos Leela, and Lola Annie. And I will drive ikot-ikot, and this will buy the tickets while you make us a house in a community of our people there, sa America." In his dream, he has them living in luxury. "What do you think they mean by land of opportunity, Mahal? Imagine the girls going to school, good schools, college pa, and they become doctors, or engineers, or better yet, movie stars in Hollywood." She laughs and pushes him away. "You have no idea what you say. Mas ayus yan, Mahal. We won't work like dogs. We'll eat meals like family, one table. We can stop dreaming. Start living."
That was M. Evelina Galang reading a piece of her story, which is called Letting Go to America. Actually, next up, we're going to hear a bit from author Borochista Kakpur. And I loved this story because it captures this feeling, this really oppressive, claustrophobic feeling that perhaps only young immigrants can understand, which is when you kind of get somewhere and you're stuck in the U.S., and I speak from personal experience, you know, in a small apartment or a small house, you don't know anybody, you can't really escape, and you're stuck with these crazy family members. I don't know, does that sound kind of about what the story is about?
Well, I think this is a story about that transitional moment when the power, it, you know, really shifts quite dramatically in a lot of ways in immigrant families, you know. And when we're in our home countries, the adults in our family have all the authority. They feel knowledgeable. They feel like they have an understanding of what's going on, and that when they make decisions about things, that those are based on real events, real things, and not ignorance. And then suddenly we find ourselves in the United States, and I think you described that very well. You know, usually we come here and we're not in the best conditions. You know, we're usually in crowded living spaces. At least the first ones usually are that way. And then suddenly there's a tremendous shift of power. The adults whom we had counted on, in both in a positive way and in a negative way, to sort of give us a sense of the world, are cowering and are afraid and very clearly indicate to us their fear. You know, they may not necessarily explain to us what they fear, but, you know, children always pick up on emotions and it affects how we conduct ourselves at that age. And so, you know, you suddenly have a tremendous shift in, you know, who actually knows what's going on. And, you know, for one thing, we usually have greater language facility much quicker. There's usually a much more unencumbered communication between children than there is between adults, so that, you know, when we as children speak to the neighbors, we get a much more unvarnished version of events than the new neighbor might give to the immigrant, or the immigrant might give to the new neighbor. And certainly the possibilities of misinterpretation are much greater among the adults because they're dealing with more nuanced and more complicated events, and with things like shame and suspicion and things of that nature, which is dramatically different among children.
Well, let's listen to an excerpt of this story. It's like a funny story. I mean, there's a lot of sad moments, but it's funny, and it's about this kid, this Iranian kid. He comes to the U.S. with his crazy grandmother, who he refers to throughout the story as Madar Bozorg, and he decides, without her knowing, to Americanize his name, and he calls himself Michael.
My name is Porochista Kapoor, and this is an excerpt from my short story, Mother the Big. Mo came every few days with armfuls of supplies, toilet paper, sheets, cleaning supplies, bread and tea. He was a single man, about as old as my father, but had no interest in taking over, he often wanted me to know. We gotta teach you to drive so you can start helping Madar Bozorg yourself, he'd say. Are 12-year-olds allowed to drive here, I'd ask. He would pound my back and say, everything is possible here. Other times Mo would talk about how he was the happiest man in the world, but always without a smile. I have it all, he'd say, but it was hard to see what. He was very thin, with a pelt of mustache that took over most of his pockmarked face. He drove a pickup truck that was very old and rusted. He worked as a plumber, but he told me I should make sure to familiarize myself with basic household repairs so I could start helping Madar Bozorg myself. Americans find me expensive, he'd remind me, often with a pride I found both inspiring and sad. He did give me one bit of advice that really made me. Change your name. I asked him what was wrong with my name, why he didn't like it, and he shook his head and said, try to imagine an American pronouncing it. What a mess. I didn't understand, but what is a mess, I wondered. Your name, which equals you, he snapped, and told me his name was Muhammad, and he had shortened it to the American name Mo. It had jump-started great luck, turning him into the happiest man in the world. I have it all, he said, hugging the air. I thought about it. What would be my American name? Mo had brought us a television, much smaller than the one we had in Iran, and he told me that it would be the best English teacher in the world. I watched hours and hours. It was from a crime show that I got my name, the name of an actor I was sure was Middle Eastern at least, Michael Nouri, It had a nice sound, and it was apparently a name Middle Easterners could pull off in this country. By the time it was September and time to go to school, I knew myself as Michael, and so did everyone else. Mo approved. Michael Jackson, a lucky name. Everyone loves Michael Jackson, he said. I did not mention Nuri. Instead, I embraced my name even more.
Actually, I love that story. That was just absolutely one of my favorites. We talked a little bit about immigrating now versus immigrating back in the 50s or at the turn of the century. I almost wonder if there's like a, you know, something different happening, like that there's more of a pride or acceptance that, okay, you know, I come from somewhere different, whereas maybe, you know, I'm thinking of like assimilation movements back, you know, back during the Rockefeller era, you know, that he would like, he worked very hard for his workers to assimilate. And there was like this whole ceremony, you know, that you would get a diploma, you would go on stage and there was like a giant melting pot and you would emerge on the other side and get this diploma. And I'm wondering if there's like, if there's more of a multicultural environment that kind of allows people to embrace where they're from, or maybe it's gone in the other direction. I don't know. I what do you think of that?
Well, I mean, I think that there's a much greater multicultural awareness. And I think this has to do with things like, you know, civil rights and immigrants coming here, sort of understanding that there is room for, you know, this greater diversity. But I also think a lot of it, and this is one of the things we sort of try to address in the book, has to do with the way that time and distance has changed conceptually from the 20th to the 21st century. You know, a good example is Alexander Heman, who is represented in the book with a story called The Bees, Part 2. And, you know, Sasha is from Bosnia. He was here on a fellowship when the war broke out, and he was sort of stuck in the U.S. He had no intentions of immigrating. He just happened to be here, and he literally could not go back. His passport was meaningless. And one of the really curious things about Sasha is that he married an American. He has children who function very much as Americans, and their second language, the language that they're learning both at school and somewhat at home, is French. His wife is not French. She's an African-American. She speaks a little French, from my understanding, but it's not anything of, it's not a family language. It's just, here's an opportunity. We want to learn this language. But Sasha retains a very intimate relationship with Sarajevo and with Bosnia. He frequently goes back. He continues to write a weekly column for a Bosnian newspaper. In other words, here is a guy whom we understand in the United States as really, really an important figure in American letters right now. And he writes in English, and he, you know, absolutely addresses American themes, if you want to call it that, but who also exists very much in Bosnian letters, who has a presence in his home country. So that would never, ever happen in the 20th century, because time and distance were very different. I mean, part of it is technological and part of it is just conceptual, you know? The fact is that he can write a column in Chicago on his computer and whip it over to Sarajevo in a nanosecond. That couldn't happen before.
At the same time, you definitely, in the book, I think it's really cool that even though we're talking about, you know, this fluidity, this new immigration in which you come back and forth, or, you know, you come back even though you're told to get out, which is something that definitely happens, you know, undocumented immigration is something
absolutely
that we're seeing as just a revolving door.
Right.
But I think it's really cool that in the book, you know, with stories, I'm thinking of the Emma Ruby Sachs story, you also address that there's still groups of people who immigrate and situations in which it's not really clear if they will ever be able to go back.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit more. We're about to hear a reading by Emma Ruby Sachs. Tell us a little bit more about her story.
Well, her story involves a human rights worker who is trying to convince a friend not to return to his home in Beirut because everything is kind of up in flames. But I think it's an important story to remind us that the world is convulsive and ever-changing, But at the same time, we feel these kind of siren call to our roots, you know. I mean, her friend, in spite of all of the evidence that suggests that he should not go anywhere near his family at that point, still chooses to return. So I think one of the things that Emmett's story tells us is that, you know, the unpredictability of certain situations sort of make us have to rethink all of our expectations constantly.
Let's listen to that story. It's a really beautiful story. Here's an excerpt of it as read by the author, Emma Ruby Sachs.
The black car outside on the street has its motor running, just in case he makes a run for it, just to let him know how ready they are. I hear a rustle. Imagine him rubbing his forehead. Staying is not an option. You're tired. You've been traveling for too long. You're not thinking straight. Let's get you out until this dies down. Then you can go back. That'll be months. Years, I think. I can't do that. My work is here. You can work from Turkey. Ahmed doesn't answer immediately, and in the silence, I hear him thinking. Here are the things he means to say. You don't understand. You don't know what it is like to board a plane in an airport hot and full of men with guns and worry that you'll never see the tiled floor under a flag of home, never smell the smell of disinfectant and mixed spices. You don't know what it's like to run away from a movement of people who have so much less than you and nowhere to run. Leave my family. Leave the house where my father first taught me how to ride a horse and how to cook za'atar and how to play dominoes. Leave the winding dark roads that take me in and out of Beirut, that weave so far into the sand that they end up on the border with Syria, and I can spit on the land my family came from. I can smell home in the air here, and the warm wind, and in the sweat smell that seeps from the armpits of men at the bus stop. I can taste it in my food, in the water that never gets cold, in the coffee that is thick, black, and sweet. You can't ask me to steal away on a boat in the middle of the night. My feet wouldn't take me. My eyes would refuse to see the path. My heart would stop before leaving without knowing I could return. But instead, all he says is this. If I leave, it will be seen as running away. People will talk. Ahmed, you don't have a choice here. You have to leave. I'm not letting you make this decision based on the opinions of a bunch of idiots who might use this to attack you behind your back. I take a deep breath. Look, I know what this means. I know how it feels to run away, but it's the right move. Despite all the loss, you're lucky. We can get you out. You'd be crazy not to go. We've all made this hard choice, but it was the right one. I don't want your life. His voice gets high-pitched, like a teenager. The phone crackles. You are literally disappeared, erased. Nothing is left. You have no music, no smells, no home, no family. You have nothing but this phone line to the rest of us who are still alive. You are dead, and you're trying to kill me too.
You know, I think what I also just love about that story and that the book touches upon a lot is that, yes, increasingly we live in a world in which you can go back and you will go back and forth. But there's also something about these conflicts in which even if you can go back, even if you do go back, and actually I'm wondering if you agree with me, this is just a thought, things change so fast in this world we live in that you can't ever really go back to the place you left.
Oh, absolutely. When I first went back to Cuba in 1995, after, you know, 30-some-odd years of being in the United States, it was a different planet to me. I mean, obviously...
you've changed, and they've changed.
Right, well, sure. I mean, I became an adult. I became a person, and I was just a kid. I was, you know, seven when we came. So for me, everything was very different. Even the scale of things was very different. You know, I remembered our home as much bigger, and it turned out, of course, that had everything to do with the fact that I was, you know, 3 feet tall. And you know, as an adult, it took on a more realistic shape. But I had a very intimate relationship with Cuba for many years after that first trip. And one of the things that was really striking to me was that each and every subsequent trip was different. Mm. You know, some things were theoretically or in fact the same, but because I was different, I saw them differently. You know, I remember the first time I got to Havana and there were a lot of buildings with scaffolding and all this stuff. And my reaction to it at the time was, oh, good, they're fixing these things up. They have a commitment to taking care of this, you know. But, you know, year after year after year, those same buildings would have the same scaffolding. And, you know, at some point, the buildings were exactly the same. But my reaction to them was very different. It was, you know, those SOBs, they're actually incredibly irresponsible. Why aren't they taking care of these things? Not for aesthetic reasons, but because they're now, you know, safety hazards. You know, kids are playing in them. People are taking refuge in these empty buildings, and these buildings crumble when it rains, and people are getting injured and dying. And so my reaction to it was, you know, much more virulent and much more present. And I felt a sense of ownership to a certain extent because I had spent so much time there. I was spending months and months and months and months in Havana. I was living in Havana. And so I felt very strongly about this. And then, you know, later, they became part of the landscape. It's part of the scenery. You don't notice it. This is just how it is.
Yeah, and it's something that our next and last story that we're going to read, Lawrence LaFontaine Stokes, and he talks about this man who is constantly going back and forth between Puerto Rico and the U.S., and just how he's kind of tired. I mean, there's almost like when you read the story, you can almost feel that cold air of, you know, when you're at the airport way too long because, I don't know, you have a massive layover or your flight got canceled and you're cold and you're uncomfortable and you've been eating junk food. And it almost like, I don't know, I felt kind of like that discomfort of always going back and forth. Tell me a little bit more about this story, though, and about Lauren LaFontaine Stokes.
Well, Lawrence is a terrific writer who's out of Ann Arbor, native Puerto Rican. And, you know, what I love about this story is that his character is a different person every place he is because he has a different relationship to being in Detroit, to being in Ann Arbor, to being in San Juan. You know, all of those places define him slightly differently. And so, and he responds to place slightly differently. And I also love that the story's kind of funny and also kind of like disorienting. You kind of have to dig through a little bit of what's going on initially. But I think it's a great story to illustrate this more sort of mobile, you know, immigrant who has a relationship in on a very, you know, basic level with, you know, different places, and as a result, you know, their own identity takes has so many different aspects.
Let's listen to a little bit of the story San Juan, Atlanta, Detroit, as read by author Lawrence LaFontaine Stokes.
He rolled his rollerboard suitcases across the San Juan Luis Muñoz Marín International Airport on the way to security, but not before stopping at El Mesón Sandwiches to have yet another quesito and a strong cup of espresso with hot milk for half of what it would cost closer to the gate. The restaurant was decorated with murals depicting the airport as it looked in the early 1960s, as it appears in that classic of Puerto Rican and Mexican cinematography, Puerto Rico en Carnaval, with the Mexican comedy superstar Ting Tan, the very extraordinary Johnny Rodriguez dressed as Doña Fela, the mayoress of San Juan, and Belda Gonzalez in her signature role as La Criada Malcriada, driving everyone crazy at the airport with her lumpen proletariat ways. But there were no television or movie stars at the airport, none whom Mickey recognized anyways, even if the country's heart was heavy with the death of Hector Macho Camacho, then and about to be caught up with the drama of his wake in Santurce and funeral in New York. My life resembles that of a boxer, Mickey thought to himself, although he hasn't been shot to death, Mickey, that is, and he's just struggling with his doctor's diagnosis of high blood pressure and high triglycerides, coping with a new regime of medications that have unpredictable side effects, such as the painful leg cramps that snuck up on him while he was having sex with a guy he met at Out Bar in Ann Arbor a couple of weeks ago, a jittery guy with a woman's name who seemed slightly out of it and kept asking for poppers. My life is like that of a boxer, he thought, constantly dodging these punches, getting on and off that plane, walking down these airport corridors, losing my patience with the poor Delta employees who are just trying to do their jobs, finding comfort in my favorite restaurants as if they were my own personal hangouts, hanging out in airport terminals the way some people hang out at the mall, getting to know them like the palm of my hand, riding their automated people movers to get from one gate to another in yet another mad dash to not miss that tight connection, trying to squeeze in a meal where there is more time. But boxers probably get to fly first class, don't have to worry so much about getting a hot meal before a flight to and from this island that is and is not part of the United States. A country not foreign enough to warrant an international flight that would serve food.
That was an excerpt of the story San Juan, Atlanta, Detroit, as read by author Lawrence LaFontaine Stokes. Achi, thank you so much for joining us. And I really actually would love to invite you to join us soon in the future to talk about some of your own work. We're actually really big fans of yours, but this is just an amazing editorial work called Immigrant Voices. Wonderful curation. Congratulations.
Thank you so very much. I'm very, very happy to have been able to share this with you. I also want to just give a nod out to my co-editor, Megan Bales, because this book never would have happened without her. She really took a lot of the ideas that I had in, you know, informal conversation and just said, you know, this is how, you know, we should do this. This is how we should frame it. And she really had her hand in a lot of these stories. In fact, stories like Emma Ruby Sachs' stories, we probably wouldn't have gotten if not for her. So I just wanted to shout out to Megan for that. And thank you very much. I'd love to join you to talk about my work. This has been great.
Gracias, Achi. I want to remind our listeners that you can comment on this week's show on our website, npr.org/altlatino. And you can also find the musical interludes we played on our website. Everything you heard in this week's show was by Cuban pianist Omar Sosa. Also, guys, don't forget to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. We are NPR's Alt Latino. I'm Jasmine Garst. Feliz Contreras will be back next week. This has been Alt Latino. Thank you.